This is Ian Pickus for WAMC News. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has so far been able to ride out the storm, resisting calls to resign amid multiple investigations into his handling of COVID-19 in nursing homes, sexual harassment allegations, and potential wrongdoing in the production of his pandemic memoir last year. The third-term Democrat says the inquiries should be allowed to conclude before New Yorkers make up their mind about his actions. When it comes to the serious sexual harassment allegations, Cuomo denies touching anyone inappropriately, but apologized for making subordinates feel uncomfortable in conversations. New York Times political reporter Matt Flagenheimer recently published a magazine article whose headline referred to Cuomo's white-knuckle ride through multiple scandals.
I think it's very consistent, according to people who've known him for a long time, with the sort of personality type we've seen. This is somebody who has obviously been in politics for 4 decades now, since his father's campaigns, and he has been reelected twice in convincing fashion. He thinks that the voters should be the ones who decide his fate, and I don't think it's surprising at all that he has refused to resign. I don't think he puts a whole lot of stock in the opinions of lawmakers or anyone else who's telling him that he should clear out of the mansion at this point.
You talk to a lot of people in New York state government who have known the governor for a while. In general, what's the reaction people have to seeing Governor Cuomo going through this right now?
I think it's an interesting combination of emotions. Obviously, there's a great deal of surprise at just the swiftness of the kind of reversal of fortunes. He was riding so high politically during those early months of the COVID crisis. He was seen as this national, even sort of global leader in the midst of the sort of leadership vacuum that we saw during the Trump presidency on the matter of the virus. And to see how quickly that all shifted for him in these last several months, I think has been sort of jarring for people who have known him for a long time. There is also this sort of abiding sense he shouldn't be underestimated. People who have seen him falter politically before, particularly his 2002 campaign for governor, which ended in disaster, there is this sense that he cannot be counted out, even when there is a whole lot of political incoming, as we've seen recently.
You know, and to a certain degree, the polls have backed the governor up. I mean, obviously, his favorability is way down from where it was during the heights of the pandemic. But he is, according to, you know, polls from places like Siena in recent days and Quinnipiac a month ago, he is retaining support from a sizable number of New Yorkers and a sizable number of Democrats.
There's no question, and particularly on the issue of whether people want to see him resign immediately, as many people have called for, there does seem to be a fairly consistent, I think pretty slim majority, but a majority who say they thought they'd like to see him continue to serve. I think the question of whether he stands for re-election next year and how that might go is something else altogether. But there is certainly a large chunk of the party, particularly among African-American voters, other groups that have been particularly inclined to support the governor in the past. And we've seen in the way that he has handled his public appearances in the last several weeks, often appearing in African-American communities around New York City, vaccination centers. He has surrounded himself with allies and has made very clear how he sees his own path to political survival.
Can you say more about that? What has been his strategy and his posture now that the chips are down?
Well, I mean, he has essentially controlled his public appearances to the point of really not allowing press. They have been citing virus protocols to keep reporters away from him, even as he's in these sort of cavernous vaccination centers. He was at Belmont Racetrack the other day, one of the largest venues in the state, I believe. There has certainly been a sense that he has controlled his surroundings, particularly because of the circumstances he's facing politically. But as far as where he's going and the people he's surrounding himself with at these events, it has largely been allies in the Black community. He's been to churches. He's been to vaccination centers, sort of projecting the you know, steady-handed leadership in the minds of his allies that they saw during the early days of COVID. I think he's trying to sort of seize the reopening in a similar way and leave people with the sense that he is uniquely suited to the task of bringing the state back in the same way that many saw him as sort of a singularly beneficial figure to have at the helm at the beginning of COVID.
Back to 2002 for a moment. Your article covers a lot of what Governor Cuomo seems to have learned about his own political way forward from that defeat in the Democratic primary against Carl McCall to run for governor. But he also learned about how he wanted to deal with reporters. Can you characterize, you know, what he learned from the nadir of 2002, as even he has acknowledged?
Sure. I think there was a sense from him and from those who know him well that there was just a lack of control. And that's a word that's often invoked in regards to the governor since he's been governor. But I think in 2002, there was a sense that he did not have enough sort of discipline. There was the most sort of infamous turn when he insulted the sitting governor, George Pataki. He suggested that he, you know, had essentially held the coat of Rudy Giuliani after 9/11, which frankly, in the scale of gaffes that we've seen in the last 20 years of politics, feels a little bit quaint. But at the time was sort of a major moment in the campaign. And it did reinforce this sense that he was, you know, in his own words that he said to another Times reporter, in that campaign, you know, young, brash, arrogant. That was sort of the perception that he saw people seeing in him. And there was some truth to it. And particularly coming in as, you know, this kind of hard-charging former HUD secretary, the son of a governor, not the choice of the establishment of the Democratic Party. Carl McCall was broadly supported by the sort of party infrastructure. There was the sense that he hadn't waited his turn, in Cuomo's case, that is, that he hadn't paid his dues, that there was a presumptuousness to all of it. And I do think that one of the lessons of that campaign was being a little bit less inclined to engage with reporters in such a sort of freewheeling fashion. I mean, he's, you know, literally in Bryant Park in Manhattan, you know, puffing on a cigar with a reporter in a profile from 2002. That is the sort of thing that we wouldn't see today.
So it becomes a refrain in your article at the end of just about every paragraph, it seems, where a spokesman for the governor denies things you've uncovered about, you know, his approach to political rivals and subordinates and coworkers over the years. As you looked back on Governor Cuomo's long career, what did you discover about the way he does operate his offices and his approach to this kind of even what his backers have acknowledged is a hard charging approach to politics?
Yeah, I think there's a consistency there. And look, certainly his supporters and even folks who are not particularly fond of him acknowledge often that there is an effectiveness to it, that he has gotten a lot done, that he has pushed through priorities of his agenda, that he has achieved a great deal politically. He's been reelected twice, as we said, in sort of landslide margins. I do think there is an acknowledgement, at least broadly, that has been an effective sort of posture for him, even if it hasn't always been a delight to work with him if you're a legislator or an activist or anyone else who engages with state government. We're obviously seeing a different moment now, and I think in the budget negotiations you could see some of this, where there is less leverage and maybe a little bit less fear among lawmakers of what might happen to your political fortunes if you oppose the governor too vigorously. But frankly, we've seen some of that already in these last couple of years since the state Senate flip. There is certainly a growing contingent of progressive lawmakers who do not owe anything to the governor, particularly who ran not in opposition to him, but certainly not as staunch allies. And, you know, the math of the legislature changes, and it certainly changes how he has to position himself. There was not the same ability to kind of triangulate between the Assembly and the State Senate. And I think now you've seen a little bit less control, to come back to that word, on the part of the governor over all that happens legislatively in Albany.
This happened after your story came out, but when the comptroller, Tom DiNapoli, referred the issue of Cuomo's pandemic memoir to the state attorney general for a possible investigation, Cuomo's spokesman, Rich Azzopardi, said effectively this was political piling on from people who have talked about running for governor themselves. And so it's a politically motivated hit. Given your reporting, what can you tell us about the relationship between Attorney General Tish James and Governor Cuomo, who used to be an attorney general himself? Given what's happened over the past few months, I mean, was it a surprise to for Governor Cuomo and the people around him to see the attorney general suddenly become, you know, go from an ally maybe to a rival?
It is complicated, to say the least. I mean, he knows as well as anyone how damaging it can be to have an attorney general on your case. He was attorney general when Elliot Spitzer was governor, and the rivalry there has a sort of long history. And in this case, you know, he had reason to think that there was a real alliance there, and he was very helpful in Attorney General James's election, endorsing her, appearing at events with her. There was a fairly strong relationship there, by all accounts. I do think this report in January on nursing homes that the AG's office released was a signal that there was not going to be any kind of, you know, full-scale fealty on the part of the Attorney General's office. And we've seen since then, obviously, in the harassment inquiry and now other incidents as well, that that relationship is, again, very complicated in this moment. But certainly the context of, you know, who might succeed Governor Cuomo were he to not seek re-election, or even if he does run again, is the sort of wallpaper for all of this. And there is certainly a belief among Democrats in the state that the Attorney General would be on that short list of people who might want to succeed him if it were to come to that.
Let me ask you a bigger picture question. You cover national politics. Have the Democrats evolved or learned anything about such scandals as this? And I ask that because, you know, your story mentions the Al Franken scandal. He obviously regrets resigning. The governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam, you know, he faced very intense calls to step down when a photo of him in blackface emerged, didn't, and, you know, survived it. Are Democrats evolving on, you know, what the penalty should be when you find yourself in a personal scandal like this?
It's a good question. There is certainly, you hear from voters and readers and the like that one lesson from particularly the Al Franken scandal is that, you know, Democrats eat their own and it's wiser to hang on and, you know, don't let your opponents dictate who serves in government. And I do think that that context is at least present here. The Northam example, I mean, all of these are obviously unique circumstances, but I do think there is something powerful to supporters of the governor about the Northam example of just refusing to leave, even when everyone nominally in a position to call for your head has done so, and that eventually the world moves on. Obviously, you know, there's a lot pending here. There are many investigations ongoing. There will be a report from the investigators whom Attorney General James chose to oversee the harassment investigation. There are a lot more sort of shoes to drop here. That doesn't necessarily translate in the same way that, you know, riding it out worked in Virginia for Governor Northam. But I do think that that context is very, very present here. And I do wonder if some Democratic voters look to those relatively recent examples and see a path to essentially keeping this governor in power if they liked him in the first place.
It's obviously a hypothetical, so no pressure to answer this. But, you know, given the calendar, it seems like there may be enough time for the governor to pull out of this tailspin. You know, we're a year and a half from the next election. Let's say these reports come out and they are, you know, misdemeanors but not felonies. You know, it's not impossible to imagine him on the ticket for a fourth term in 2022, is it?
No, look, and we're a year and a half from the next election, and we're considerably less than that from the next primary, which can often be, you know, decisive in New York State. So that the Democratic primary, at the point when this, you know, report from the AG's office comes out, you've already heard supporters of the governor making this case. They made it to me over the course of reporting this story that, look, we're going to be basically a year away from deciding this democratically, multi-democratically, and why not just let this play out, let the voters dictate where the state goes. And I would not be surprised at all to hear supporters of the governor, and maybe even the governor himself, make a case like that once we know a little bit more about the state of that report.
Matt Flagenheimer is a reporter covering national politics for The New York Times. His article on Governor Andrew Cuomo was in The New York Times Magazine. Matt Flagenheimer, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.